Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a
welcome to The Media Project, an inside look at media coverage of current events. I'm Judy Patrick, former editor of The Daily Gazette, and now I'm vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. Filling in today as host for Rex Smith. With us is Mike Spain, former associate editor of the Times Union, WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and last but not least, WAMC Morning Edition anchor, producer of this program, and UAlbany adjunct professor David Gustina. Thank you all for being here.
Hi, Judy.
Hey, what a difference a week makes and an election makes for the news media, or at least potentially in 2025 and beyond. I wanted to start with you, Ian, because President-elect Trump has nominated some very high-profile New Yorkers to important positions in his cabinets, and that also has opened up some election coverage for you going forward. So what's the newsroom doing, and what's your approach to covering these transitions?
The first thing we've done, and I have to give credit to my colleague in the North Country, Pat Bradley, who kind of spearheaded this, is trying to game out regional reaction when this is a very top-down, announcement-heavy transition that's happening. You know, President Trump will put out a statement and say, Elise Stefanik's going to the UN, and that was widely expected, of course, that the Northern New York congresswoman would be in line for promotion here. And now we're in this middle area where there's potential candidates who might be meeting with county chairs, but information is hard to come by. So we're trying to, number one, explain what will happen next in terms of a special election. Also, remind everybody that things have changed since the last time a Northern New York congressperson was poached for an administration. That was John McHugh, which set off a couple of special elections right afterward. And then number three, who might be able to fill in? I mean, is this a seat that Democrats think they can win back? At least based on current results, probably not. So who do you have on each side to make their case? I've been trying to, you know, reach out to all the people I know to find out who's on the list and who isn't. And then separately, we have the former Long Island Congressman Lee Zeldin, who is going to be in line for the Environmental Protection Agency. And I happen to be speaking with New York 20 Democrat Paul Tonko on our Congressional Corner series, and his subcommittee is in charge of overseeing the EPA. So you're trying to get regional reaction. You're trying to hear from the stakeholders who care about the environment and such issues to find out what they think about it. And I think, you know, the thing I've noticed, and I was just writing on this, is that people are trying to keep an open mind right now. They don't want to prejudge. They want to understand, as we've all heard, that President Trump gets to make these appointments by virtue of his victory. And we don't really know what they're going to do yet, although we can take some guesses. So it's been a very rapid time of transition. The coverage has been relentless right after the election. No rest for the weary.
You know, but what you say brings home the point that all news is local. And then one of the things WAMC does a lot is try to keep track of these state political operatives like Capital Connection and Legislative Gazette. And then you have those connections or those contacts when something like this breaks.
And that news feeds each other. So Ian's telling you what Pat Bradley did. We also have Aaron Shell Levine, who is reporting on potential picks for that seat, that Stefanik seat. So when I have that information for me, when I go on with Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay, just before I came on this program, I asked him about this because I have this information. And he threw out, by the way, Ian, Chris Tagg's another one he mentioned as
right,
a potential.
From the
so
Assembly.
Now I'm just communicating that with Ian for the first time right now. So this is how news works. You've got information. You start to interview the players, a prominent Republican, a minority leader in the state assembly. We're going to ask them these questions. And yes, we're trying to keep an open mind, like Ian says, but we're also not going to shy away, for example, asking the minority leader, well, what about Lee Zeldin's record on the environment? What about his record in Congress? It doesn't seem like it's a very good record, and giving him an opportunity to respond.
And the last time around with the Trump administration, you know, New York, especially in the Northeast where we are, became sort of the blue resistance to what Trump was going to be doing or trying to do. This time, it was a clean sweep. So the Republicans won the House, they won the Senate, and they won the White House, and they're going to be able to get their way, at least for the next couple of years. What we have to do here in the Northeast, because so many of the people that we cover are going to be leading whatever resistance there is to the Trump agenda, is to cover them in the right context. You know, Governor Hochul was quick, the governor of New York, the day after Trump won, had a press conference with the attorney general to say, you know, the rights of New Yorkers will be protected no matter what. We're ready to fight. But she also said, and I had a phone call with President Trump and we're talking about where we can work together. And that will shape the coverage that comes out of at least our newsroom. How are people responding? Some are jubilant and some are digging in.
Mike, as one of the editors at the Times Union for so many years, you've seen these stories before. And so what is different this time around in terms of media coverage of what's happening with the presidential transition in New York State politics?
Well, obviously, people in New York will have a lot to say about Lee Zeldin and whether he is qualified and how he would perhaps manage the Environmental Protection Agency. My guess is there's many environmentalists who will jump to the opportunity to criticize this appointment and talk about why they don't think he, based on his experience in New York and his demonstrated support of fracking, that, you know, it'll be the story, and a lot of New Yorkers will be part of that national narrative. When it comes to Congresswoman Stefanik's position being vacated when she goes to the UN, and I think everyone is expecting she'll get approval to become the UN ambassador, I think that for Ian, it's just like the election didn't stop. That's going to be a very important race because Republicans have a slim majority. When you count in other appointments of members of Congress that President-elect Trump has indicated, it's going to take a few away. There's going to be other special elections. There might be the opportunity for Democrats to get into a more, maybe leverage a little better their relationship with the Republicans in Congress if they need votes for certain things. So they may decide that there's an opportunity here and they might start pouring money in, and some popular Democrats may signal an intention to take the position and run for that seat. As you know, it's a very red seat, but you don't have to live in that district in order to run. All you have to do is be a New York resident. So it'll be interesting to watch. So as you said, Judy, all politics is local, and this is going to have a big impact on local politics.
And to that end, I want to say one thing in defense of the news media. You know, our job is to say what's going on. And we're all accused of fostering an environment where it's a permanent election in the media because we love the horse race and who's up and who's down. And I think that's true to an extent. But look at what Mike's talking about. Immediately, we're going to have a special election in the North Country without a party primary. So it's our job to step in and say, here are the choices that people are going to have. And at a time when the election is not on the ballot with a presidential race. So we have to put some light on it. And also, Mike Lawler in the 17th House District in New York State, immediately after being reelected, started taking aim at Governor Hochul. He's widely seen as getting ready to run against her. A plant in Western New York closed down, and Lawler from the Lower Hudson Valley was immediately out with a statement accusing the governor of blowing it. So the 2026 race kind of started, and our job is to say, here's what your members of Congress are doing and talking about. So the election didn't end. And I kind of played myself by saying, oh, I just got to get past Election Day. I should have known better.
Well, you and the media, all you do is cover the horse race.
Well, you know what? That's something I'm worried about, which is what we've always worried about here at WAMC. And Ian can speak to it best when it comes to Elise Stefanik. We need these people to talk to us. We need them to come on the air and tell us what they think. Now, we're probably never going to hear from her as UN ambassador, but can we get the candidates in this race on our air? And no matter who ascends to the seat, will that person come on the congressional corner and talk to you, Ian? We need that. And I'm not blaming us for that, but we see what happens in a climate where politicians, and now more than ever, people distrust the media. They turn away. And yet we're doing a public service. We have no agenda. We just want to talk to you.
And you know what? This is part and parcel of one of the lessons from this election. You know, Elise Stefanik in 2015 and 16 and 17 was a critic of Donald Trump's. Now, that hasn't hurt her in the long run. Obviously, she made a big bet and it paid off. But she's been dogged by these questions about her evolution. Same thing for J.D. Vance. Same thing for Marco Rubio. Is it in their interest to tell you what they actually think and have it be on the record as the political winds change? They may find it less and less advantageous to do interviews in the long run, knowing that that didn't hurt President Trump in this race or other candidates on the Republican side. So I think, you know, we don't know how this will all shake out in the long run. But as David says, the trend toward sitting and answering questions, that might be going away to a degree.
And we've said it before, Ian, but it's not just the Republican side. It is the Democratic side as well. And I single out the governor of this state as well as the attorney general, who no matter how hard you try, we can't get them on the air. Now, it's a statewide program, the Capital Connection. What on earth are you doing as a politician, especially if you've been elected to office, not speaking to your constituents?
Right. It benefits the politician, but does not benefit the public. It's an old soapbox of mine, is the fact that we need to listen more, but we have to have people talk to us in order for us to listen. In that vein, can we talk a little bit about the flood of information we've gotten out of the incoming president with his appointments? There are so many stories coming so fast and furious that I worry that we're missing some of the big stories. And how do we keep our eye on the ball?
Well, I think that's a very effective strategy. Every day you get two or three more people, and it's very hard to keep focus on the appointments that he announced 3 days ago when you're hearing about one that just happened an hour ago. And it does challenge the news media. It's, I think, a very deliberate and a very effective tactic. The announcement that Matt Gaetz, the Florida, now former Florida Congress member, to be the attorney general, is stealing all the attention away from other appointments that might have been questionable, such as the appointment of Lee Zeldin to run the EPA. Well, no one is talking about that now because that happened a few days ago. And the Gaetz thing, in my opinion, will suck up most of the attention on the media. And because of that, other appointments that may have otherwise been questionable or controversial won't get the attention and the scrutiny that would ordinarily happen if these things rolled out slowly. So I think it's all part of a strategy to essentially play the media and make tumble over itself trying to keep up.
You know, this maybe is not a novel observation, but Trump thinks of his daily existence in the White House as reality TV. So the people he's selecting come from their ability to spread a message on TV, namely Fox News, and he approaches it like reality TV casting. You know, you give them the personalities, there's drama. Last time around when he was there, the firings were handled like Survivor. That is how it's being approached, and that makes it really challenging, as Mike says, when the choices are so unconventional, to give them the appropriate scrutiny, because what gets attention is like the wow factor.
Yes, but also, if you read the deep dives on these people, they're there. You can read about all these people and what their history is. And, for example, how do we know how Lee Zeldin acted? Even Pete Hegseth from Fox News, he has quite the backstory. I'm not going to go into it here, but these stories have been written. But the wow factor is wow, and then we go on to something else, not wow, we're going to read the whole article.
Right, so we know the strategy. We know we're getting played. What do we do about it?
I think the answer is to do the job. It's to tell the story, make it available, make sure, as you just said, David, make sure that people know the backstory, have access to the backstory, and continue to apply the attention and scrutiny required so that the public is aware of what's going on. I mean, if people don't object to some of these appointments, members of the Senate will not feel compelled to object either. So it's going to be political action committees. It's going to be elected officials, organizations, non-government organizations that are going to make the cases of whether these people are qualified and would be suitable in these very, very important positions like, you know, Attorney General and Secretary of Defense and Head of Homeland Security. It's incredible.
You know, I think we have to take a lesson, too, from the outcome of the race, which is that you can uncover a lot of, you know, sort of unsavory things about candidates, and that may not be a deal breaker for voters who have made a choice here and with very little mystery about what that choice would mean.
Agreed. And you know what? We've got one great mission, to do our jobs, as Mike Spain said, to report the news. But Richard Toefel adds to that in the Columbia Journalism Review this week under a headline, "So What Now?" He says, "We must also do it with restraint and proportion. We must prepare to defend the Constitution that makes its existence as the world's freest and most powerful press possible. And the press must display judgment and discernment about the difference between the first two tasks, between what may be merely unwise or even dangerous, noxious, or offensive, and that which would threaten our fundamental liberties." Game is on here, folks.
Right. And we definitely have to be relatable. And I took notice of the fact that viewership is down dramatically at MSNBC following the election, down 53% from October, and it's up 21% at Fox News. What is happening there, do you think?
People like to be with the winner.
Winners and losers, yep. Exactly. And I don't like the headline because it says, "Viewers flee MSNBC and flock to Fox News."
They did not leave
MSNBC and go to Fox News. They just left MSNBC, and more conservatives are now on Fox News.
Well, this happened after 2016 to MSNBC, and it gradually picked back up. And the same thing happened to Fox after 2020, after Joe Biden was elected and Donald Trump was defeated. I think there's a level of remorse for when the candidate that you heavily supported, and unless you heavily supported Trump or Biden or, in this case, Kamala Harris, you probably didn't watch those. You probably watched the mainstream, like the network TV or your local news, to get most of that. But if you are navigating to an MSNBC or a Fox, you've got already a political bend, and you're probably frustrated, and you don't want to go on there and hear people lecture why this didn't happen, how awful this is. It's pretty demoralizing.
You don't want to feel like a loser.
Yeah.
I mean, the Chicago White Sox last year did not do great ratings, and it's sort of a human nature.
I get it totally.
Yeah, and I also think that there were, in some respects, especially right after the election, people who supported Kamala Harris were so disillusioned they needed a break. They stepped back.
Absolutely.
We talked a little bit about the fact that Trump usually will generate an increased interest in the news media. We expect to see subscriptions to go up to major news organizations and the clicks to go up as these wild and crazy stories come out of Washington. So there's that. I think it will rebound for MSNBC. But in part, I think maybe they're disillusioned because if you watched MSNBC, you were pretty sure that Kamala Harris was going to win. And when she didn't, maybe they lost a little bit of trust and confidence.
And I think that happened to Fox in 2020. People were upset that Fox actually called Arizona for President Biden early in the evening and were just so upset at that. They thought it was unfaithful to the guy that they were pushing. And they actually reported it correctly, as it turned out. You know, so people turned away from Fox, and that scared Fox. And as you all know, it very much contributed to Fox promoting election fraud stories without having good, solid reporting to back it up.
Which was a costly mistake.
It was a very costly mistake, but it all came out in the court depositions that were part of the case, where they ended up paying 800 and something million dollars to the company Dominion Voting that made the voting machines that they allowed to be slandered on their airwaves and across their medium.
Well, and so what does that mean for the media going forward in another Trump administration, when he has even less guardrails on him and a little support from the Supreme Court when it comes to immunity and lots of statements about fake news, enemy of the people, go ahead and hurt them physically, and maybe we'll futz with the libel laws on top of it?
People in the media are worried. I mean, they're worried about the government cracking down on them. And there's been a lot written about ways the government can put a damper on coverage by hassling reporters covering protests. But there are other things they can do in terms of whoever owns the media gets to control the message. And we have Elon Musk controlling X. We have Trump controlling, what is it?
Truth Social.
But then you have, you know, big companies like Sinclair owning a lot of newspapers.
Bezos and the Washington Post.
True. And so those are the kinds of things I think people need to be aware of going forward. In terms of the value of independent media and independent public media, independent private media, and what do we need to do to make sure those operations continue
Well, but will they be able to operate fully anyway? Because the chill, the press chill, is here. One of the articles we've been reading is, why did Bezos and the Washington Post decide not to endorse in the election? Is part of this because they see the tea leaves, they see this authoritarian figure coming. He'll use the power of lawsuits and trying to tie them up financially and chill the press.
Well,
and they'll self-censor. That's the whole point, self-censorship.
Right. Right, exactly. They'll take the attitude, well, let's not poke the bear.
Right.
You know, we don't want to go too far there because it just might cut us off and allow
ourselves. We'll lose access.
Yeah, we'll lose access. We'll be undermined. But there is some hope, Judy, that a lot of independent organizations, a lot of, you know, smaller operations because of the internet, you know, it democratized the news media. And it doesn't take a lot to get the message out. They will work to preserve our First Amendment and the Constitution, and then that will help sustain during this very tough period. But already, you saw it at the end of the previous Trump administration, certain reporters were barred from press conferences and press access, and you'll probably see a lot more of that. That's a chilling, as you say, David, a very chilling, has a chilling impact.
And now, I would not make any mistake about it that the Trump White House to be and the allies around him have declared war on reporters. Now, there was a feedback loop the last time around where any critical coverage, which every president gets critical coverage, that's the job, that's what you signed up for, was seen as a volley in an ongoing war. And I think it's left us in a very bad place because we want to be able to hold up a mirror and be critical without, you know, having the president-elect say, I wouldn't mind if someone shot through the press pen. That's not good. And I think we're starting out in a position this time where, you know, Marty Baron's famous quote, we're not going to war, we're going to work. You know, I feel like because of the way Trump has approached press coverage is not necessarily the case this time around. What makes me worried, because I hear the comments and I read the emails that come into this station, which is a small newsroom, is that, you know, day to day, we're not engaged in a war here.
No.
We're trying to find out what's going on. We're at city councils and we get lumped in with this sort of Promethean struggle.
Yeah. And you know what? Even more dangerous is the threat against licenses like CBS's license. And the FCC appointments now could be big because, you know, they've never been too warm toward broadcasting institutions like public broadcasting. So we always have to be aware of what they say and then what they potentially could do.
Well, this is the time for organizations, you know, like foundations to come forward and defend the First Amendment by helping to support independent media in a variety of ways. And I think it's also to pay for First Amendment lawyers. I mean, we do have a First Amendment that is one of the biggest protections a lot of other countries don't have, and we have to preserve that. But I would be lying if I didn't say I wasn't frightened that this Supreme Court might weaken it.
I was just about to say, but it's going to end up at the Supreme Court.
I mean, Clarence Thomas, one of the justices, has talked about undoing Times versus Sullivan, a landmark New York Times decision that basically protected media from libel suits that were fallacious and, you know, just meant to be scattered. You can still commit libel, but the standard is much higher.
Malice aforethought.
Yeah, that's the higher order of things also. But you get the lower level where you get your readers or listeners saying you're biased whenever you write anything remotely critical of the person they support. And, I mean, that's been there for a long time. But it's far more so nowadays than it was.
Some people attribute this to the deterioration of our education system. We don't spend enough time teaching history and civics. And that is a problem in New York State. It's been taken out of the requirements that schools have because we're focusing on STEM, as we should. But that's happened all across the country. We're not teaching the value of our First Amendment and our Constitution. A lot of people don't understand it. I mean, it's a reality. A lot of people just don't get it. If you ask people what is a tariff, a lot of people don't know. If you ask people what a fascist is, they just know it's a negative term. They couldn't define it for you. So we need to educate people better because we're now paying the price.
Amen.
Amen. Hey, before we leave, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Murrow Award being rescinded for a documentary, the National Geographic did called Retrograde, the unprecedented decision to strip this prestigious journalism award from National Geographic for Retrograde filed revelations made in the Washington Post about the fact that the documentary showed the faces of Afghan contractors who cleared mines for the U.S. and putting them at grave risk.
And were later killed, some of them.
And if not for the Washington Post reporting, this would have gone unchecked. It's a basic journalism precept to limit the harm you do.
Minimize harm.
And in this case, substantial harm was done.
It was reckless to be that way with the lives of people that spoke to you, that gave you the story that you were doing the documentary on. And it is amazing that you would rescind a Murrow Award. And in this particular case, I think it makes the statement, and we're talking about it, and we should.
Yeah, right. The RTNDA rescinded it, but they were also up for criticism.
Right, because...
because of the way they handled it, and they didn't ask enough questions about how the images got out in the first place.
Right. I think whenever you do a story, you have this basic trust with the people you're interviewing, and they agreed to talk to you, and they trust you that you are not going to put them in harm's way. You're not going to misquote them. You're not going to do a... And so it's that basic contract you have with the sources, and when something like this happens, it makes anyone... whoever talks to any reporter think twice about it. So I'm glad to see that our ethics guidelines or our ethics standards were upheld in this case, but it can't undo the harm that was done.
No, and that's as harmful as you can get.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks to Mike Spain, Ian Pickus, and David Gustina. I'm Judy Patrick.
Thank you, Judy.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to join us next week on The Media Project.
Newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the world.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and Mike Spain, former Associate Editor of the Times Union. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.